Welcome to Dialogue Across Difference, an event series hosted by the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Join us as Center Director Larry Jacobs and guests engage in conversations across the political and policy spectrum on issues of the day.
Good afternoon. I'm Larry Jacobs. I am director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance and professor at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. I'm pleased to welcome you to Restoring Intellectual Diversity on University Campuses with Ramesh Ponnuru and with Vin Weber. This is an inaugural event of Conservative Voices at the Humphrey School. It's a new lecture series that we will be bringing to you. It highlights conservative, prominent thinkers, public officials on a variety of policy areas who bring a variety of backgrounds. The series serves the center's mission to generate dialogue across differences by stimulating vigorous and civil discussion and debate. All of you will be part of this conversation. For those joining us online, you'll see at the bottom of your screen, there's a Q&A button. That's your spot to join us. Click on it, submit your questions. And I'll be honest, I've got a bias towards hard questions, questions that raise things that have not been talked about, maybe disagree with some of the comments that have been made. So please join us, become part of this dialogue that we are having today. Also, if you're joining us and you'd like closed caption, you'll see also the bottom of your screen, there's a closed caption button. Vin Weber and I are very pleased to have with us the Dean of the Humphrey School, Nisha Bashway. She is very supportive of this series, very encouraging, and we're delighted to have the Dean with us. Since joining the Humphrey School in January 2022, Dean Bashway has led the school's strategic planning, which singles out, among other issues, inclusion and dialogue across differences as one of its core values and guiding principles. Thank you so much, Dean Bashway, for being with us.
Thank you, Larry. And good afternoon. Welcome to those at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs and those who are joining us online. It is my pleasure to introduce the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance's first event in this series, Conservative Voices at the Humphrey School. I am so very thankful to see this program get off the ground, as today's event and this series very much aligns with our school's mission and history as we delve into the vital topic of fostering a wider range of ideas and viewpoints. We know that learning is enriched when we have a diverse group of people and ideas representative of our communities, state, nation, and world. Building on the legacy of its namesake, the Humphrey School community aspires to co-create innovative solutions to the world's most complex problems through leadership, service, and inclusive engagement locally and globally. It is critical that we embrace a rich tapestry of people and perspectives, engage in respectful and open discussions, and provide platforms for a multiplicity of voices to be heard. As such, the Humphrey School prepares future generations of students and current professionals to succeed and to lead our multicultural democracy. At the Humphrey School, we value inclusion and dialogue across differences, nurturing a culture and environment where everyone feels welcome and heard. And I'll just say that again, where everyone feels welcome and heard. This event exemplifies our unwavering commitment to stimulating a vibrant and civil discourse across the academic landscape. Today, we are joined by Ramesh Panuru, the editor of the National Review. He will share his insights on the importance of diverse perspectives and their role in shaping our society. I'd like to thank former Congressman Vin Weber and Professor Larry Jacobs for their leadership and vision for this event series. Today's conversation serves as a testament to our commitment to creating spaces where ideas can be shared, challenged, and refined. Our aim is to provoke meaningful questions, even those hard ones that you want to type in the chat that Larry will get to, foster wide-ranging debates, and encourage ongoing discussions as students and participants are exposed to differing viewpoints. We at the Humphrey School wholeheartedly embrace this ethos, recognizing that a comprehensive academic conversation should encompass a wide spectrum of thoughts and opinions benefiting all members of our community. It is through conversations like these that we challenge our own assumptions, expand our horizons, and cultivate a community that values robust, respectful, and insightful dialogue. So I invite you to join us on this journey of exploration and discovery as we embrace the richness of diverse perspectives and engage in meaningful discussions. Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Dean Boshway. Appreciate that warm, supportive, and really wide-ranging welcome. Vin Weber, so great to be here with you.
Always.
We're at this again. We seem to be drawn to doing these sort of things.
Just keep conspiring with each other.
Yeah, and it's always fun because we get together and Vin's a very smart, interesting person. Ramesh, thanks so much for coming out from DC. You wrote this piece in the Washington Post. What's your argument?
Dive right into it. But first, let me thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. I'm glad you arranged for good weather while I'm here. Don't invite me to do any December events, but August is just fine. My argument in that column was that the lack of intellectual diversity, and particularly the lack of center-right viewpoints in college faculties, is a problem. It's a problem for, you know, as a conservative, of course, I would like to see the ideas that I subscribe to get a fair shot at universities, but it's a problem even for non-conservatives. It's a problem for universities themselves, in part because it reduces the necessary public support for universities. It's destructive because it encourages an anti-intellectual streak among conservatives that is already too large, and it damages liberals by making them less capable of responding to or learning from conservative points of view. And so for all these reasons, we need to take that lack of viewpoint diversity seriously.
I want to ask a question, broadly speaking. I mean, university, broadly speaking, has always been thought of as a center-left community. I don't mean just this university. I mean universities right. Generally. And yet we have a lot more focus on this issue now than we ever have had before. My question is, are we just coming to grips with it now, or has there been a change in the way that universities and the academic community think about discourse and issues? Is it really different than it was before?
Well, you can find data suggesting that universities leaned left as far back as the Eisenhower years. In my column, I cited some data from the early 1990s suggesting a sort of a 2-to-1 liberal to conservative ratio in university faculties, which is, of course, lopsided, very unrepresentative of the public at large. But later data from 2015 or so, I believe, had it at 5-1 now. So this is a tendency that has become more pronounced. What you have, it is no longer something you can describe as a liberal tilt. It is more of a kind of ideological monoculture. And simply by being that monoculture, it has different effects and a different kind of character. It is it is experienced as a kind of, it can be at least experienced as a kind of orthodoxy, and sometimes as a stultifying orthodoxy, in which people feel less able to speak their mind without facing a kind of severe social censure. And there's been some data on that too. The Cato Institute did some research it's done some research over several years. And really, even over the last 4 years, there's been an increase in the number of people who say, I feel that I can't express my points of view. Interestingly, it is throughout the political spectrum. Conservatives feel it, moderates feel it, liberals feel it. However, there's a political tilt there that the more right you go, the more you feel that way. When I see numbers like that, it seems to me that they are expressing something. So as I said, one trend here was the monoculture, the sort of the it may be a cascading effect where you start out with a slight bias and it becomes bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. But then there's also been some other changes. One is that there's been this kind of radical expansion of the concept of safety. And so we want students to be safe, not just safe from physical danger, but over time, it has sometimes morphed into safe from being exposed to points of view that offend me, right? Which is obviously a very different concept. But if you treat it all as being that same word, safety, mm-hmm. It becomes a license for intolerance of other points of view.
Yeah, I remember a couple of years ago, there was a professor at Georgetown Law School that expressed conservative points of view, and the students on campus wanted to establish a crying room where they could feel safe. I thought, really, we've gone somewhere that I can't quite fathom. If that's what I would never have admitted anything like that when I was that age. I probably still wouldn't. But
it's not a formula for psychological resilience.
No, it's really not. Let me ask one additional thing. It's not just the numbers, it seems to me, although those numbers are informative, but the intolerance of anybody reflecting a different point of view. I don't think that was always the case. I think that there have been conservative voices on campuses outnumbered, but certainly there for a long time. Now, as you pointed out, it's not just that there shouldn't be so many of them, but they should not be allowed to speak.
Right, or they don't belong here. They're not. Yeah. They're not part of our community. Yeah, I mean, I think that I've certainly had great left wing professors, but they were fair minded, right? They weren't going to grade your papers on the basis of whether you agreed with them, right. For example, and they were going to entertain other points of view. They would encourage you to speak up if it was that the kind of classroom where there was a broad ranging classroom discussion. And people don't always feel that way. And I should say, since I've been concentrating on the faculty, it's not always a faculty driven thing. Sometimes it's student driven.
Right.
So. You're, and I just want to clarify this. You're not talking about excluding. You're not saying the left should not be part of university campus if that was possible. You seem to have a more expansive view of this.
Yeah, I think one of the effects we're seeing of the orthodoxy on campus is there is increased unhappiness, particularly among conservative politicians, and this sometimes. Leads to calls for kind of regulation. You have to be, I think, very, very wary of that kind of thing, because you don't want to actually chill free inquiry and academic free speech by having legislation that is heavy-handed. And beyond that, the problem can't actually be solved that way anyway. You can't sort of force an overwhelmingly left-wing professoriate to fairly present other points of view. So you have to make a conscious effort, I think, to make sure that other points of view are being represented on campus.
You didn't say this explicitly, but I'll be helpful.
Yeah.
It sounds like some of the legislation we've seen in Florida with Governor DeSantis and Republican administration kind of excluding or barring critical race theory, teaching of or perspectives related to race. And it sounds like that's the kind of thing you're saying. That's not the right approach.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there may be individual provisions of some of those bills that are worth supporting, but overall, that can't be the solution that we go.
So you went to Princeton University, you a proud graduate. I've been impressed by by Princeton's James Madison program,
mm-hmm.
And I know you're familiar with it. What is it about that program that you think is a model that other universities might adopt?
Well, I think it's a great example of introducing other points of view rather than trying to exclude points of view. There's nothing in the Madison program which is about suppressing left-wing points of view. And in fact, some of the people who participate in their programs or are affiliated faculty are strong liberals or left-wingers, moderates. They don't all have to be conservatives or libertarians. But they are people who are all committed to a robust intellectual debate, and they trade in the currency of academia, right? Arguments, reason, logic, evidence. One great example of this is the Robert George, who started and still leads the Madison program, spoke up in defense of Peter Singer, the famous utilitarian philosopher who argues that under certain circumstances, it can be right to commit infanticide. And Professor George is could not be more on the opposite side of things. He's a very strong pro-lifer. But he said, look, the way to respond to Singer is by presenting better arguments, not by saying that he can't make his arguments.
And, you know, it's interesting looking at what the James Madison program has talked about. As some of its main concerns, private property, free enterprise. Okay, that makes sense. The place of religion in public life, but also constitutional separation of powers, checks and balances, judicial independence, and an agenda that maybe in our own time, some might read and say, wait, that sounds anti-Trump. So I think this is part of your point that this is a commitment to a set of ideas, intellectual inquiry in which rigorous methods and evidence are brought forward, not an ideological or partisan agenda.
Right. It's not a place devoted to the manufacturing of partisan talking points or really presenting an ideological point of view. The goal is not to make people graduate as conservatives, although there's nothing wrong with that. But as people who are capable of thinking through these questions, who understand the conservative argument, even if they don't agree with it.
Or maybe, you know, libertarian argument,
right.
Or, you know, some sort of, liberal or progressive point of view. I mean, all of that is possibly the benefit of creating a space for dialogue and difference.
I'm going to talk about the magazine a little bit because the you could argue that the National
Review. By the magazine, you mean the National Review?
National Review. You could argue that the National Review led the way to the conservative intellectual movement of our time. And yet, I just wondered how you are dealing with the fact that on the right, the Trump right, I guess, there's a great intolerance of anybody that doesn't defend Trump. How do you at National Review deal with that phenomenon and find writers and defend writers that keep alive and try to advance an intellectual position on the right?
It has been a tricky business. One thing I've found is that Trump himself has been so polarizing, not just in our wider society, but even in my little world, mm-hmm. where there are people who are furious at you because you're anti-Trump, but you're not anti-Trump enough.
Yeah.
And there are people who are furious with you because sometimes you defend Trump, but you don't defend him enough. And my own approach in this has just been to sort of call them as I see them. And that has led to, you know, sometimes you defend them, sometimes you criticize them. People will sometimes say, oh, are you anti-Trump or anti-anti-Trump? It depends.
Yeah, it depends on the issue.
Yeah.
Well, I can imagine that it's a difficult situation for you.
So you've laid out an argument that it's the overpopulation of liberals in universities that's led to this decline of intellectual diversity. Is there another possible explanation, which is just a supply issue?
Mm-hmm.
They're just not conservatives going into the academy, and few conservatives going into, let's say, the study of literature or political science and economics, which are increasingly driven by, you know, pretty sophisticated and demanding methods, microeconomics and beyond. And rather, you know, the smart conservative would rather go into business right, where you can make money. So is it a supply issue, or is it, you know, kind of these left professors who are kind of hogging the university space?
Well, to some degree, these are factors that work together. So if you think you're not going to be welcome somewhere, maybe you're not going to apply in the first place, or you won't do all the hard work it takes. If you think at the end of the day, you're going to be judged unfairly. I do think there is a, you know, there long has been a lower inclination to join the academy on the part of conservatives. I don't think that can explain this extreme tilt that we see now, or the pattern that, you know, the more elite the university, the less likely you are to have that kind of intellectual diversity. That I think it's interesting how the argument about this question is very much like the argument about affirmative action, but it's in reverse. So when liberals see a statistical disparity of groups in a particular field, they're likely to jump to the phenomenon has to be explained by bias. And conservatives are likely to come up with all these other explanations. That's not bias. And neither one sees this in the other sort of argument. So when it comes to the academy, so many of the liberal academics who responded to my column and were upset by it basically were saying, you know, it's not, we're not discriminating against conservatives. They're just so dumb. You know, you know, we're not keeping anybody out. They just for some reason don't want to be here. And you can come up with more and more of these sorts of explanations. But at the end of the day, some of them start to look like rationalizations for discrimination. And I'll say for conservatives too, you know, there can be such things as unconscious bias. And, you know, we can think when we're on the receiving end of it, we can see how that would work in universities, but we too often don't apply it to all the other places there can be unconscious bias.
So now we're seeing universities like Princeton and mm-hmm. others who are stepping forward and saying, no, we're going to make a conscious effort to recruit and hire conservatives. So would you expect an increase in the pipeline of conservatives? I mean, I honestly think if you did a search in literature mm-hmm. and, you know, you did do affirmative action by viewpoint, you'd be really hard pressed. It's just not a lot. And I can say in the areas that I've run searches, it's just not a lot there. I mean, it's driven yeah. by the academic diversity over methods and theory, which we could talk a lot about that, but it's not driven by ideology or viewpoint. It's really within the academy and these kind of disciplinary debates and discussions.
Well, I wouldn't be looking for a radical and rapid expansion in the conservative percentage of faculties nationally. But what I would be looking for is consciousness of the problem and a lack of complacency and slow progress. I don't kid myself that this is not a problem that has developed in a short period of time, and it won't be solved in a short period of time.
See, I thought you were going to make another argument, which is it's not just up to conservatives mm-hmm. that, you know, intellectuals that, you know, make up the vast majority of universities ought to be stepping forward in their classes and their research and wrestling in an honest way
yeah.
with you know, traditional conservative arguments, Edmund Burke and others, that this isn't just on kind of
that is right. And I also think relatedly, free speech is not a kind of natural phenomenon. It's a civilizational achievement. It has to be nurtured, and professors have to go out of their way to make it clear that that the class is going to be conducted in a way where all points of view are allowed to be expressed and respected, or at least the people that they're attached to are respected.
I want to explore that just a little bit further, because the other side of the coin, I think, is there do have to be some lines drawn about genuinely destructive points of view. You know, I don't want somebody to teach anti-Semitism or what are the, how do you make a differentiation?
Yeah.
So that you do have a free expression of points of view, but draw the line against genuinely destructive behavior and ideas.
So, this is sort of the core question, really, when you have any of the controversies over platforming people or over cancel culture. And I think the great mistake is to think about toleration mostly as a principle, when it's really mostly a disposition. It's a valuable disposition. And I think that the way we, you know, and applying it to cases requires judgment. It's inescapable. There's no way of getting around the necessity of judgment. But I think that when we make judgments about who is platformed and who is canceled and so forth, in addition to being mindful of the particular context, right, the norms that govern a tenured professor are not going to be the same ones that govern the CEO of a company, for example, where the shareholders might have some very practical reasons for not wanting that CEO to get involved in controversy one way or another. But I think whenever there's this a controversy about somebody having said something or expressed a point of view and a lot of people are riled up, I think we should ask ourselves, can this point of view be held by an intelligent person of goodwill? Not, is this correct? Not, am I offended by it? But not, would I like to see this viewpoint triumph everywhere? But can an intelligent person of goodwill sincerely hold this point of view? And it seems to me that on, almost by definition, on every actually controverted question in our social and political life, all of the answers to those questions can and are held by such people. And if that's the case, and if we ask ourselves that question, then answer it with charity, that I think can help us settle a lot of those questions. Now, if somebody is a neo-Nazi, for example, I think we can reasonably say that is a person of vicious character, right? This is a point of view that does not need to be heard. Now, it also has to be said that it is a culturally contextual inquiry that we're in, because we would not tolerate a speaker now who advocated segregation, right? Because we have made the kind of moral progress in our society where we're the only people who now maintain a need for racial segregation are persons of vicious character. Would have had, in the 1940s, would have had a different set of answers to that.
I'm going to just kind of continue down this line. I think it's very important. And it really comes to, which viewpoints do you include? Mm-hmm. And you've been talking about the vicious types. There are viewpoints that sometimes, hang out with conservatives or politically conservative, sometimes, some of the factions around it. For instance, I was intrigued by a recent poll that about a third of millennials believe the earth is flat. What's the standard by which we would say, okay, that viewpoint ought to get equal time? Or the kind of more politically salient view of the human contribution to global climate change and global warming. 97% or so of peer-reviewed scientific research in all the important journals says that that's happening, Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about it. There's questions about variability, ocean temperature, and other things. But as to that basic fact, it's accepted.
Right.
But, you know, we've got, you know, certainly folks in the Republican Party who don't accept it. Now, should that be included because it is kind of a political viewpoint by a major party? Is there, as you said, affirmative action by viewpoint? How do we sort out those sort of questions?
Yeah. So, you know, of course, I guess the context in which this might come up is, let's say you have a professor in one of the scientific disciplines who is an outlier on that question, or, you know, or at least is maybe says anthropogenic climate change is not likely to have catastrophic effects, for example. I think the answer to that question, if this person is, again, sort of conducting himself in the currency of academia, you know, if he's offering arguments, even if they're maddening or frustrating arguments that most of his peers think are wrong, I think, you know, if this person is up before the tenure committee, you judge him by the quality of the publications and the sort of the normal criteria. You don't put a thumb on the scale against him because of that. At the same time, if he is just a crank, if he can't meet those standards, that's a totally different question, it seems to me. I don't want, I don't think you're going to be able to find the flat earther who can meet the test in geology, for example.
Well, I certainly would hope that would be the process in terms of tenure and promotion. But we get lots of requests here at the Humphrey School for different points of view to be brought in and given a platform. And, you know, to be honest with you, my viewpoint about that is there credible evidence? Mm-hmm. Is there some sort of body of research that would provide support for that? And I've struggled with the human contribution of global climate change, because it looks to me, when I look at the vast amount of research, it's a topic that is really, you know, it's been decided by credible researchers. Again, with the very important caveat that there are differences about variations and about the vagaries of ocean temperatures and other sort of minor issues. Am I off on this? Am I being intolerant?
I would say it is not. So let's say you had a politician coming to speak who was a vocal opponent of the idea that humans are contributing in an important way to the warming of the planet. I don't think it would be right to exclude that person because of that point of view. I think it would be perfectly fine to, you know, hold up signs in protest, to ask pointed questions, to force them to answer hard questions about, you know, why is there this overwhelming scientific consensus against you? How do you deal with, you know, all of this evidence? But no, I wouldn't exclude such a person.
It seems to me, just to stay on climate for one more minute, that there is an intolerance on the left on that subject as well, because I agree with Larry, the preponderance of evidence is that human activity is contributing to climate change. But that does not necessarily lead to the conclusion that you should ban power mowers. Right. I mean, and yet every proposal that comes down to combat climate change is, if you're against it or question it, you are put in the category of a climate denier.
Right.
And that's an intolerance too, because with all the strategies that we've been pursuing may not work.
Yeah, no, and I agree with that. And I don't, in fact, support most of the proposals that people make to combat climate change.
Thanks for all of you who've been adding questions. I'll be collecting questions from folks here as well in a moment. But let me get to some of the questions that have already been submitted. How do you distinguish between conservative voices and pressure to maintain the status quo culturally and politically that leads to discrimination against women in science? Would the adding of conservative voices contribute to the persistence of that?
Interesting question. I would say not necessarily, and it shouldn't. I mean, our being alive to one form of bias should not make us blind to all other forms of bias. And I'm, you know, all in favor of conservative female physicists being able to get the jobs that they deserve.
Do you think religion ought to be playing a larger role in universities as part of its public life? This has been, you know, this one of the trends, you've defined it in terms of ideology, liberal conservative, but there's also been this tension about secular versus religious. Is that something that we ought to be talking about?
Well, I do think that there's a closely related phenomenon of bias there that I suspect that even your kind of a superstar academic when he's applying for a job, if that academic happens to be an evangelical Christian, is probably taking some pains to downplay that aspect of his identity.
We've got other questions here. That's been one of the ones that keeps coming up. What schools do you think are excelling at welcoming intellectual diversity? We've talked about Princeton. Yeah. Are there other places?
Well, I think the University of Chicago's free speech principles are something worthy of emulation, and in fact, that have been emulated. And I think that there are some encouraging signs here and there all the time that university administrations, in many cases, have decided that they do need to speak up for a culture of discussion and debate.
And just to be clear about that, because you mentioned Chicago, we've seen this at Stanford and elsewhere. This isn't kind of, a quiet, demure sort of exercise. Often these statements are coming out in the context of very heated controversy,
right,
in which, you know, have presidents and deans standing up to students and saying, I realize you feel strongly about that, but, you know, your sense of being hurt, or, you know, the microaggressions that you're sensing cannot override the larger protection for speech and dissent and for posing critical questions.
Yeah, that's right. Of course, at Stanford, it was the shameful treatment of Judge Duncan when he was supposed to be able to speak there, and that it ended up not being an intellectual exchange of any kind. And the administration did say, you know, this is not appropriate. This is not the way that we treat opposing points of view here, which I think was very important.
Yeah, but just to get to that issue, because I think that was very pointed.
Yeah.
You had a number of students saying that being in the room was a harmful experience.
Right.
And what I'm hearing you say is there's a trade-off here, and that the value of the speech overrides the sense of a group that it's harmful to them.
Yeah, you know, somebody, one of the earlier controversies at Yale, I think it was over something completely ridiculous, like people's Halloween costumes. And there was a student quoted saying, you know, people talk about all of this free debate, but this is our home, you know, and it needs to be a welcoming place for us. And that's right. I mean, you know, while you're here, certainly it is your home, but it's a particular kind of home. It's an enterprise that is dedicated to, you know, construction, obviously, but also to intellectual inquiry. Left-wing protesters are trying to drown me out.
Well, this brings up a difficulty in dealing with the question of intellectual diversity on campuses, because the problems you guys were just discussing were not caused by left-wing faculty members. They were caused by the student body.
Yeah.
The customers, if you will. How do you cope with that?
And not always, you know, sort of all of the students.
No.
But the ones who are most intolerant and most willing to try to silence other people.
Right.
Which is why I was saying it's not, free speech isn't a natural phenomenon, and it has to actually be stood up.
That's
for.
A good point.
And a culture of free speech, you know, and the courts are, you know, the law of free speech is very important, but at a university, you need more than that.
And this is not a kind of gentle exercise. I mean, speech has always been recognized at times as being, you know, vigorous and contested and controversial. And I say that because I think maybe some people listening are thinking, yeah, these are important points, but there's a fire to this. There's a heat to this. There's a, you know, a real sense of kind of primal importance to a perspective that's not being expressed, that is being expressed.
Right.
And it strikes me, it's precisely in those contexts that you need institutions with clearly articulated principles around speech, around dissent.
And at the same time, civility doesn't mean you have to be milquetoast, right? You can take very strong points of view and advance them forcefully while also respecting other people's right to express different points of view.
We have a lot of questions here from folks here and online about what does conservative mean today? And the reference is, okay, you've had people who advertise themselves as conservative Republicans, but in the recent era, they've advocated defaulting on the U.S. debt. They have raised questions or made arguments for terminating parts of the Constitution. And, you know, and the list goes on. How do you, you know, give, what is the conservative, you know, viewpoint at today?
Yeah. So conservatism is a house with many mansions. They don't always have connecting doors, as we're finding out. When I think about my own conservatism, I think of it as first starting with gratitude for all of the good things in our lives and our society that we haven't been responsible for ourselves and that we need to preserve and build on. And in our country in particular, I think of an American conservatism. I think an American conservatism worthy of the name has to be about conserving our political inheritance from the founders, you know, a constitutionally bound free society. The task of conservation doesn't mean, as you know, Burke acknowledges, doesn't mean you never change. It's not merely passive, but requires great activity. You to protect any achievement, both from internal decay and external attack. And I think that conservatism should constantly be engaged on a multitude of fronts in fighting that battle.
I'm a reader of your columns, so I feel like I've got some familiarity where you've taken strong positions, pro and frankly critical of some of the Republican policies and what's going on with the campaign trails. Here's a question from one of our friends here. Is there a path through the disinformation and conspiracy theories that dominate a lot of conservative thought today?
Yeah, I think it's a golden age we're living through for conspiracy theory. And the thing I've noticed about them is if you believe in one conspiracy theory, it's never just the one. It's you've got to collect them all.
Yeah.
Interestingly, the guy, I found this out when I was writing something about conspiracy theories a couple years ago. The guy who came up with the term sheeple, you know, wake up sheeple, believed every stupid conspiracy that you could possibly imagine and then some you wouldn't imagine. I think that, you know, if I think about the recent changes in conservatism under Trump, the larger protectionist wing in the Republican Party, I'm not for it. I tend in most circumstances to be in favor of free trade, but that sort of thing doesn't bother me as much as the incredible torrent of conspiracy theorizing, often led by Trump himself. That, it seems to me, was something that I had thought had been successfully marginalized within conservatism by William F. Buckley Jr. Right. when he very carefully but forcefully drove the Birchers out of the movement. And all of that style of thinking, unfortunately, has come back. And I think it just simply has to be fought.
We've been talking about intellectual diversity on university campuses, but we haven't talked much about colleges with Christian affiliations.
Right.
Should there be intellectual diversity at Baptist and Catholic colleges?
Yeah. So I do think that you have a special case when you have a college with a particular religious mission, as opposed, you know, when it reflects that mission, as opposed to a university that says it's devoted to free and unbounded inquiry, but then just happens to be a kind of bastion of a particular kind of political orthodoxy. I don't mind having a landscape in which there are many different kinds of colleges. I would say that the Baptist University or the Catholic University needs, for the good of its students, to be able to expose its students to other points of view fairly. In practice, I think that's going to be that is going to take more of an effort, not less of one, at such an institution.
We've been making the argument or discussing the argument that progressive ideas are overrepresented in universities. Question from one of our friends online: is it possible that progressive thinking is simply more compatible with a world that is changing as rapidly as ours is today?
No. No, I mean, look, progressives obviously tend to think that, right? One could, I think, just as easily say that in a world that's rapidly changing, it's even more important to hew to certain timeless principles, for example, having to do with human rights and limited government. So no, I don't think that the mere fact of social change sort of makes the case for progressivism.
If that were the case, Lippmann's question, the polling would show that progressives are happier people. Mm. It's exactly the opposite. That's some of the most interesting polling you can look at. Is there is a divide between people on the right and people on the left in terms of their sense of well-being, sense of are they happy with life? And the people on the left are less happy. So I think that rebuts the argument.
And everybody's getting less happy.
Yeah, that's
also,
right.
It's the
right.
Other finding.
Certainly the world isn't getting happier.
Yeah.
So there are different ways in which you can set up and encourage intellectual diversity on campuses, particularly with regards to conservative viewpoints. Question here from a friend with us today saying, should universities look to the Hoover Institute at Stanford as a model because it creates a rallying point for conservatives on campus? We talked earlier about the Madison Project, which doesn't follow that. It's more open and there's a range of perspectives and it's not ideologically a rallying point.
Well, I think there have been a lot of great scholars affiliated with Hoover. I think the Madison program has had more of an impact on the culture of the campus because it's tried to. The Hoover Institution has, really tried to be a kind of enclave of a certain kind of thought, but hasn't really been about the business of changing the culture of the campus. And I think, that's needed.
At the University of Money, there's a great deal of focus and money spent on diversity in terms of race and gender and sexual orientation. Are you aware of any current push for diversity initiatives to include diversity of thought, intellectual diversity? Is that happening?
I think the main way it's happening is through the creation of these centers that may not be explicitly conservative, but are open to conservatives. I've seen it at Arizona State University, for example, particularly during the governorship of Doug Ducey. He really tried to create a bipartisan board that where people would be devoted to this inquiry. I went there and spoke. I was up. I was talking with David Leonhardt from the New York Times, a terrific liberal commentator, and I think that is a successful model that is being replicated and should be replicated more.
From the perspective of a university president or dean who's maybe looking at this whole area of speech thinking, that looks pretty flamboyant. you get involved in these debates and you could end up in the New York Times or front page of the story. And, it's understandable why you wouldn't be necessarily inclined to head that direction. Do you think, though, that there's an argument about institutional protection for a dean or president to step in like Princeton and Chicago and now you know, after its unfortunate incidents we've seen at Stanford, is there a case for basically inoculation?
Well, first, I mean, I just think it's part of doing your job, right? I mean, to reaffirm what a university should be for. But I also think, and I alluded to this at the beginning, I do think we have seen a real drop off in public support, particularly among conservatives, for universities. And I think that that's dangerous. I think universities are very important institutions in the life of our society. And if we get to a point where conservatives, you know, don't want to support them, don't want to donate to them, don't want tax dollars going to them, possibly even want to regulate them into submission, that would be, I think, very bad. And it is one reason, one additional reason why I think that university leadership should be mindful of the problem.
One trend that brings to mind is, and this is not just on the right, but we're increasingly hearing serious people question the value of a college education at all, arguing instead for some combination of technical institutes and apprenticeships. At one level, that makes sense. You can get good jobs doing that. But is that trend threatening to you?
I'm for that trend in general. I think it is a mistake to tell people, you know, you have to go to a university, you have to get a college degree, and if you're not, you're a loser. Mm-hmm. And you're never going to amount to anything. I think that's been a destructive message. And so I think it's important for there to be many pathways to success in our society. And I do think that we have neglected creating those pathways for people who are not, who maybe are not getting the college degree, or at least are not taking the conventional route to that college degree. So I don't mind that. I do think it sometimes can spill over into denigration of, you know, colleges and the life of the mind, that I don't think makes sense. Mm-hmm.
We were talking a moment ago about the commitment on most university campuses to diversity with regards to race and gender. These are things that you can see usually, but you can't see a political perspective or viewpoint. Should universities be asking candidates for their political viewpoint so that can be incorporated into hiring?
Well, I think that if you ask people about their political viewpoints, a lot of people would feel pressure to mask some of them or downplay them in the current context. You know, I think that the fields that I think we should be particularly concerned about, say, you know, politics, history, so forth, you're going to have a sense of the viewpoints from the published work of a lot of people or from the academic work that people have done. And what you really need to be doing is A, not holding it against them that they have conservative points of view, but B, I think seeking out people. Why is it that, you know, nobody in the last 10 years that we've looked at has been a conservative, for example?
You know, I'm going to express a little skepticism about that. I think, you know, I think of searches I've been on American politics for Congress positions or presidency. It's so entirely focused on theories that are grounded in the scholarship or methods that come out of economics, that the political viewpoint, if it's there, it's tertiary. It's not really, serious scholars that are publishing in the top journals that are peer reviews, this is not a platform for articulating a perspective. I think
I think that focus on methods can sometimes be a screen. Or so, I mean, like if you're a student of Harvey Mansfield in politics, for example, you're not going to be a quant head, you know? So we should be mindful of that kind of effect as well.
I think you're on thin ice there, because I think there are plenty of qualitatively oriented historians and political scientists and sociologists who are some of the most progressive socialist, you know, academics out there. I just think it, you know,
you need to look at the pipeline too.
Once you kind of go into this pool of who's applying, I don't think there's a kind of a marker that would be equivalent to race and gender. I just think it's it's more dicey, and you combine it with the issue we talked earlier about pipeline. I think it's.
What would your advice be if I could turn the tables? If you're
that's not fair.
To a conservative grad student who wants to make a career in academia, how would you tell that person, you know, she should be totally upfront about her point of view?
My advice would be you want to publish in the best journals and with the best university presses possible, and then look to write opinion pieces that would say, based on my research or my analysis of existing research would lead me to these conclusions. And the Washington Post for many years, and I think it's coming back, had something called the monkey cage. And there you would see scholars leveraging their own research or that of others to apply it to contemporary current debates. That would be my suggestion, because I think all, you know, credible faculty search committees are first going to go to the norms and the practices that we are trained in and that we face all the time as we try to get publications.
And if her research was on the efficacy of building more prisons and hiring more police as a means of combating crime, you wouldn't say, well, that maybe do something else?
I think if the methods are strong, I mean, you know, for instance, you know, that sort of, if I had a PhD candidate who was working in that, I would say, okay, you're going against the current here. Identify what the kind of competing theories are, and then make it clear. This is what the current theory is. I'm going to be presenting evidence that has not been used before, and here are my findings. And then you want to have a section that's like the mea culpa. I realized that I wasn't able to answer all these questions, and legitimate, you know, questions can be raised about what I've done. I don't think, you know, there's a kind of, for most faculty, there's a kind of the ideological bar. Mm-hmm. It's not that there isn't an ideological tilt. That I agree with you, but I do think it's a more complicated story as to how we've gotten to the 5-to-1 ratio that you've talked about.
Maybe, but I also suspect that you may be charitably assuming that more people are like you than there are.
Isn't everyone like us? Okay, I've got a couple more questions here, and we'll be wrapping up soon. This question from one of our friends online said, what about doctors who are conducting research and may be unpopular? At a time, this happened during COVID. We had, you know, quite a bit of, you know, differing research going on, particularly at the beginning. But it's part of the scientific method that people, you know, have differing findings. Does that lead to, you know, some of the same issues of kind of the lack of free speech, of the kind of punishment for those who are finding results that are unpopular?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this gets into a much larger discussion that's important and I think fascinating, actually, about the role of science in our culture, which I think we saw particularly during COVID, where we sort of demand a kind of oracular function be played. We want science to give us answers that science by its nature can't actually give us. And I think we had this whole thing about following the science. It was, well, the science doesn't tell us how to make a trade-off between, you know, health and other goods, for example. I think that kind of sort of dysfunctional cultural attitude towards science ends up posing a threat to medicine in a lot of different ways. And I think that we are seeing not just sort of attacks on science from the left and the right, but also attempts to, in medical schools, make them put political missions more front and center. And I think it's something worth fighting.
There's quite a bit of discussion now about CDC's public communications and the failure to articulate uncertainties. Because people read their kind of public advisories and took them as, you know, this is the gospel. And
there's all kinds of problems. There's also just this ridiculous degree of risk aversion at CDC. This is a group that doesn't believe that you should ever order your steak medium, right? I mean, the official CDC recommendation is it needs to be well done. Well, but that is a mindset that spills over into a lot of areas.
Well, I want to apologize for serving you rare steak last night.
Yeah.
So I want to just wrap up here with a few final comments. First, upcoming events. We've got a terrific program tomorrow at 11. Should U.S. elections be nonpartisan? Rebecca Green is joining us, a noted legal scholar. We'll be talking about the history in the U.S. of relying on rival partisan actors in elections. Then we have another of the series of conservative voices coming up on Monday, September 25th. We'll be joined by Amy Gadara, who's the Secretary of Education of Virginia and has been one of the leaders in the parental rights movement. And she will be our next guest.
And a Minnesotan.
And a Minnesotan, yes. There will be a video of this conversation. It'll be posted in about a day or two. It'll also be out in the podcast form. So whatever you rely on, we're going to help you. If you've enjoyed this event, please consider giving a donation. As I mentioned, our dean is here, and she'll be grateful, and she'll let me know that. I also want to let you know that we are grateful to the construction workers out front who were doing their job, but kindly took a break so that we could finish this program. Warm thank you, Ramesh Punaru and Vin Weber, for this great conversation, and to all of you for joining us.
Yes.
Thank you.